that, I guess, theoretically is the concept. It also engages the, somehow they're going to quantumly entangle the semiconductor material. I guess, not quite sure how you do that, how you keep it in that form, and how you extract energy from entanglement. I've never really thought in terms of entanglement being a high energy manifestation of matter, but that's what I've been able to pick apart from the poorly written popular articles on the subject. Again, there's no practical example at all. It's all a theoretical construct that people just write flighty articles about at this point.
Really need is a battery that could be molded into different shapes, have significantly more power and a smaller form factor. That's the key.
Well, they sort of already did that. Point of lithium polymer is that it was formable, and so you could maximize the volume that you're given in any electrical device to take up some, to have the most massive battery that holds the most massive amount of power storage capability.
Well, the battery chemistry needs to change. And that's a challenge. That's a challenge, trying all these different doping agents and other chemical ways of doing things. It's actually very, very complex, and all the permutations that go along with that.
Well, that's what battery chemists do day in and day out, year in and year out. The guy who had the breakthrough with lithium was very famous. He kind of predicted that he was going to come out with something new, but he passed away before then, and I tend to doubt that he had anything particularly new. So you can add dopants and such to the primary chemistry and maybe tweak it a little bit. You might get 10, you might get 12% improvement. You have to pretty much change the chemistry to really change the baseline of any kind of power storage device. And, we're kind of running out of chemicals to sort of do that. Lithium is the lowest density, lowest weight, highest energy level material we have. The problem with using things that have high storage carrying capacity is that you're sort of building occasionally a bomb, which you no doubt have read in the news, especially in China. They have a lot of problems with their electric vehicles that are powered with problematic lithium-ion batteries that break out into a chemical fire, which is much more difficult to deal with than a fuel-based type of a fire, wood or gasoline or what have you. So, the price of high energy storage is that if something goes wrong, it goes much, much worse wrong.
Well, and these battery technology with lithium ion has to be done, has to be manufactured very, very high standards of quality, precision environment. You don't want to deal with cases of thermal runaway. I remember the Boeing 787 had lithium ion batteries, and then they pulled it. I don't know if they put it back. I know they redid the casement for it and put it back, but I'm not sure it was with lithium. Maybe you would know about that.
I don't know. There are some slight variants of lithium ion that behave relatively better. I have rechargeable batteries for my radios. They're made using something called lithium iron phosphate. They have a little bit better safety margins than the lithium ion construction. So they might have swapped it for that technology. It's very similar, and so you don't have to re-engineer your electronics too much.
Once had a lithium-ion battery. It was a very small one. It was powering an MP3 player at the time. And I just for giggles, if it was charged, I kind of bent it a little bit, and wouldn't believe the amount of heat that that gave off. Amazing.
Yeah, especially when it's charged. When it's discharged, it still has a little juice. But when it's charged, the thermal runaway is not fun at all. Years ago, people regularly took pictures on airplanes where some guy's cell phone had a thermal runaway and, you know, a chemical fire. Very, 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 very dangerous. Not a good idea to play around with lithium-ion batteries unless you know what you're doing. And even then, it's probably not a good idea. I've seen a whole bunch of YouTubes where guys peeled away the paste and the electrodes, and they still started a fire. You know, you got to give these things, hopefully, the proper respect, because if you don't, you know, they'll bite you.
Yeah, I wonder if lithium batteries are still stored in checked baggage on airlines, that they don't pick these up. You know, that there's still a lot of things that are packed that shouldn't be packed and put on aircraft as baggage, checked baggage.
Well, judging by human nature, I would assume that there's a certain amount. It's a lot less now that it's supposedly disallowed, but you'll never be able to shrink it down to zero. People will sneak it in some way or another, and fortunately, there's nothing documented that that's caused too much of a problem with airplanes yet. But it's human nature to try and get away with the rules and such. Human beings don't like to, at least a significant percentage, don't like to follow rules.
Agreed. Yeah, that tends to be the case, doesn't it?
Yep.
Anybody else on this frequency with us?
Well, hopefully there are other people, because it is a net. I guess they're just sitting back and listening. Some people participate on this net. There are some people that I have never heard on this net a single time, and I meet them, and they kind of tell me that they enjoy listening, and they do other things listening while it's on, but for some odd reason, they don't really talk. So although I can't tell you exactly how many people are out there, there are people out there other than just us.
Comment?
Certainly.
This is WA2VDH, John. I just wanted to mention about the lithium batteries. I know there was at least one of those programs, I think it's Air Disasters, that comes on National Geographic Channel, where they documented a fire that started on an aircraft that was shipping in its cargo hold lithium-ion batteries, and they demonstrated how the fire was very fierce. It was very difficult to extinguish, and it was caused by lithium-ion batteries. Okay.
Thank you, John. But I mean, that was probably before the ban, because they were transporting those batteries, and now that we have a ban, you're not allowed to do that. I mean, I can tell if I bought some kind of a little gizmo, if there's a lithium-ion battery in it, because it has that enormous sticker on the side of the box that limits its options of how you're supposed to ship it.
Those programs on Air Disasters, they are at least 4, sometimes 5 years old, out of date. So this was probably before the ban on the shipping of them.
Right.
Yeah, I would think so. But I would also, again, assuming human nature as I understand it, I am sure there are people out there that sort of know that they're not supposed to pack these things, and they kind of hide it in some nook or cranny, and they say, one lithium-ion battery is not going to hurt anyone, type of thing. So I'm sure there are people who break that restriction, and, no security person is 100% infallible, so I'm sure there are lithium-ion batteries that are transported on planes against most people's wishes.
Kind of scary, because this reminds me of many, many years ago. There was a flight with Air Florida where they were carrying oxygen canisters. And these were not supposed to be checked. They were supposed to be, you know, on board the aircraft because they were for aeronautical use. And they caught a raging fire. So there's a parallel, you know, between that, even though they're two different types of technologies and chemistries, that some things just should not be brought on board or brought into the hold compartment.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of regulations. Some people like regulations. Other people find that regulations slow things down too much. But, yeah, there's a lot of dangerous things that have people got away with for years and years. We're learning a little bit more each year. Human beings are weird people. Weird things. They fear things that aren't terribly fearful and are fine with things that will kill you. Back in the turn of the 20th century, electrification was a big thing industrially. A lot of workers demanded hazard pay because they were afraid that the electricity in the outlets was going to kill them. Nevertheless, in an adjoining factory, a bunch of young women regularly licked radon-infested paints with their tongues in order to bring the paint brush to a finer point so that your watch could glow in the dark in the night. And a lot of them ended up with cancer of their jaws and died because of it. So, you know, we were fearful for electricity too much. We weren't fearful for x-rays. All those fluorescein machines at the shoe store would fluoroscope your feet so you could wiggle your toes and see them through your shoes. That wasn't a terribly clever idea, but people did it. Asbestos exposure and benzene exposure, the list is practically endless.
Well, these are environmental things that need to be strictly controlled. However, you know, you live in a society where some chemicals are necessary to maintain, let's say, an adequate food supply over an extended period of time and for transit.
Well, again, it sort of depends. There are chemical agents that were very effective, but because the risk was deemed to be greater than the benefit, they have been disallowed. In some cases, you can make stuff safer. In some cases, you can limit exposure. And in other cases, the regulatory agencies just make it illegal. And yet there are ways around it. We have talked in the past about lead added to low octane gasolines when we were younger. So we had a lot of lead fumes, which no doubt gave us some degree of IQ dampening. This was made illegal years ago, and yet private airplanes require lead additions to the fuel. So if you go to an airport and get some fuel for your small plane, it will be leaded gas. So, you know, some things that most people think is completely illegal is actually legal under some circumstances.
Fossil fuels are basically they are a finite resource. And, you know, it's going to run out. It's a question of time. So the quicker that we can make the transition to more environmentally friendly technologies that could give us as much or more power in a smaller form factor than what we have now would be a major win.
MEC2GS. Generally speaking, yes, I would agree with you, except that I'm sure you know lots of people who either work for petroleum companies or have stock in petroleum companies and think there's nothing wrong with fossil fuels and there's such a thing as clean coal, which there really isn't. You can clean it up a bit, but it's still rather dirty. So, again, you know, fusion. It's only 20 years in the future.
Yep. Fusion is the fusion will be the answer to many things, especially if they could go ahead and miniaturize it.
Well, I don't know how big it's going to be. So, you know, first you got to figure out how to do it, and then figure out how to shrink it. And no doubt they will find some inherent problems that haven't been addressed yet. One of the things is that fusion produces waste heat. Any kind of energy ultimately disperses as waste heat. So you're going to have something that produces additional heat on the Earth. And there's only so much heat that can just be dissipated by, you know, radiating out to space. So then everyone will have a problem limiting your fusion energy to limit the amount of the heat that the planet is soaking up, and otherwise you'll get climate change. So they haven't really mentioned that at all because, again, it's 20 years in the future, which means it's probably 60 or 70 years in the future. But I am sure that when that point comes, there's going to be lots of discussion of what the heck do we do with the waste heat.
It'd be interesting to be born 100 years from now and see the technologies that were invented, you know, during that time, or perhaps visiting a barren wasteland.
Yeah, it could be Buck Rogers, or it could be Planet of the Apes. You never know.
However, energy in that is very critical. And energy of types is expensive, especially chemical energy. Prices of natural gas and the amount of energy in natural gas, compared to, let's say, propane, which has more of an energy density, it's just extremely expensive.
Yeah, it's a matter of supply and demand. Some forms of energy are much more readily available and obtainable than others. They all have slightly different characteristics. They all require some form of infrastructure to maintain them safely. So it's always going to be a kind of a problem. Meanwhile, Frank on Echolink, I think, was trying to make a comment. Frank, what did you want to share with us?
Yeah, very good. A couple of years ago, some startup I was working on so-called nuclear batteries. Was that so much hot air, or did that startup go bust like a lot of them? You recall anything about that? Go ahead.
AC2GS, complete hot air. Matter of fact, it made a big splash, I think, about 6 months ago. I think someone made some fake photograph of a Chinese nuclear battery. The thing that's really nuclear batteries is that they give off, it's a radioactive material that slowly decays with beta decay. A beta decay is electrons. So if you shovel up the electrons, you can have a battery. The problem is the battery's output is rated in, I think, nanoamperes. You couldn't kind of run almost anything. I mean, you'd have to really search hard for something that runs so efficiently that you could run anything with this type of a battery. And, you know, ganging them up wouldn't really help a great deal because they're very expensive. And it's radioactive material that's decaying, so it's a bit dangerous, too. So it was a complete scam.
Yeah, I guess I'm not too surprised. And I was wondering what the downside of fusion would be if it worked. I mean, you can't just get something for nothing and keep saying, well, it's nearly unlimited energy and completely environmental friendly with no waste product. And there's absolutely no form of energy that has no waste product. So I think that's a good point. The waste product is heat, and it's going to have to be dissipated somewhere, and we've already got a problem with too much heat from industrial processes on the Earth. So it sounds like that's going to have its problems, too, when that finally works. Go ahead.
Yeah, although I don't think people, at least in discussions I've heard, don't seem to bring up the waste heat issue. What they're really talking about, byproducts to fusion, are relatively benign. You know, fusion, as it operates in the sun, outputs helium. You know, getting rid of helium isn't a problem. If anything, scientists would like another source for helium because we're running out of our own. Our helium is basically trapped in caves and gas pockets. What happens is heavier elements have alpha decay. Alpha decay is basically helium nuclei, and then it traps electrons, and you get helium gas. So, you know, most of the helium is based on decay, so if you wait a couple of billion years, you'll get another supply, but it's going to take a much longer time. So the chemical byproducts are incredibly safer than fission. Fission produces a lot of highly radioactive isotopes. Some of them have a short lifespan. Others have a very, very, very long lifespan, so it's a much filthier problem. Then you still got the problem with getting the fuel for the fusion. It's not like most earthbound fusion is not going to operate like the sun with helium. You're going to need you're going to need deuterium. You're going to need tritium. You're going to need helium-3, maybe. You need a little bit starter fluid for it. So that's another big problem of where are you going to get enough to fuel the fusion reactor. So there's always going to be problems. Nothing is perfect.
Fuel fusion is unbelievably inexpensive. So much in seawater, deuterium, and tritium.
Sorry, but you're wrong. Tritium is not in seawater. Tritium is a decay, radioactively decays rather quickly. You buy yourself a nice vial of tritium, which I have, and I think it has a half-life of about 12 years. So you're confusing tritium with deuterium. Deuterium is not that difficult. You can filter it through seawater, but for it to work on Earth with our temperatures and pressures, you're going to have to add tritium and or helium-3, which is not that easy to get.
Okay. Yeah, well, I stand corrected on that one. However, I thought they just used in the fusion reactors, I thought they just used deuterium. No?
No. At this point, fusion reactors are experimental. There's no consistently running fusion device. Tokamaks and other the laser pulsers and such are all, it takes a day and a half to set everything up, and it takes a femtosecond to do the experiment. And they can't reach the temperature and pressures like the core of the sun, where helium or even deuterium is enough. You really have to spice up the formula to get it to take place in anything that's physically capable of being built by our technology.
I wonder how long they were able to contain the fusion reaction for the longest period of time, 1 or 2 seconds, or less than that.
Incredibly less than that. We're talking usually about pulses of femtoseconds, trillionths of a second. Anything more and the power output would have melted the entire building. As it is, these experiments, if successful, generally do melt all the local equipment and have to be replaced. You know, you'll never hear of them pulsing a test fusion reactor twice in one day. It's not feasible. So it's an insignificant fraction of a second. It's long enough to take energy readings. And some of the energy readings are sort of phony. No doubt you've read that we've crossed the point where the amount of power that we put in is less than the power that was taken out of the fusion experiment. What they fail to mention is they're talking about the energy put in by the machine that they're using that has a low efficiency. So the amount of energy put in was really 100 or 1,000 times greater, but the amount that was converted to laser energy was less than the output of the fusion reaction measured. So they haven't even gone to unity yet. It takes a lot more energy in to get energy out.
So what's to say achieve breakthrough for the balance? If they were able to go ahead and have a teeny surplus, but I think when you net everything out in the end, I'm not too sure if they really did.
No, unfortunately they didn't. As I said, it's wordplay, unfortunately. If you want to count the amount of energy that was emitted from the firing laser, yes, they got more energy out of a fusion reaction than they put in with the power of the laser. But the laser is not 100% efficient. The laser is about 0.1% efficient. So they had to throw more than 100 times more power to get that 1/100th of the power output that triggered the fusion reaction. So in terms of total energy in and energy out, no. We haven't gone anything close to unity. If you want to play word games, for whatever that's worth, you can say that the amount of energy from the laser igniter was less than the energy emitted from fusion. But that's not the whole story.
Points well taken, for sure. Roy, are you a physicist or a teacher?
That's interesting. The gentleman who ran this technical net for 40-odd years, at the beginning of my participation in this net, I was sort of a mystery, I guess. So he gave his opinion. He thought, based upon emails that I sent him, because my antenna was terrible and I couldn't get into the repeater, that I was either a physicist or a teacher. No, I'm a physician.
I'm just curious, what type?
I am a general internist.
Medicine has always interested me, especially when I took pre-med. Even though I'm not a physician, I'm in IT. However, fascinating.
Yeah, I never actually was pre-med. I was a chemistry major with a minor in economics. But I audited physics courses, and I was able to get a computer account by doing that. So I played around with computers as well in college. I went to New York University.
Which university?
My first name is Roy.
No. What university did you attend?
New York University, NYU.
Oh, NYU, sure, of course.
Yeah, it was a good university then. My understanding is it continues to be a fine university now. I have no second thoughts. I think I chose correctly. Places like Columbia wanted me to take engineering courses and degrees because that was unfortunately in the 70s when the bottom fell out of engineering and all the engineering schools had to figure out what the hell to do with themselves. And I was not particularly inclined to go to engineering school, so I thank you, but no thank you. I went to NYU instead. It was very nice. I probably, if I add up all the numbers, ended up making money. I taught chemistry in my senior year there.
Do you have an interest in maxillofacial surgery?
Not exactly. Surgeons are a different kettle of fish. I was, you know, in medical school. It's kind of a tradition, unfortunately, to be annoyed, tested, and lambasted by surgeons. So you kind of make the decision of either going along with the bully or turning left. And I turned left. So internal medicine is, you know, is decidedly not a surgical specialty. I'm generally interested in almost everything, but not particularly maxillofacial surgery.
What is your take on the efficacy of the mRNA viruses, mRNA vaccines, and the methodologies used to go ahead and create them?
I thought at the time, and I still think, that they were a boon. They're miraculous. They broke a lot of rules when it comes to vaccinations. Previously, before messenger RNA-based vaccines, it would take anywhere from 10 to 20 years be able to develop a vaccine for anything. You know, if you go through it historically. But messenger RNA has changed that significantly. It's proven itself, in my opinion, to be safe, effective, and very pliable to different things. As time goes on, I have no doubt that medical science will try to tweak and adjust messenger RNA-based vaccines for other infectious processes to the betterment of mankind.
Oh, yeah, certainly understand that and agree. It's all what research is being done, what technologies are being developed, what the future might hold. Is there anyone else on the net here with us to have any questions?
Well, I would hope so. We've had a few people drop by, but, you know, maybe they're more fascinated to listen than to talk. But if anyone out there wants to join the conversation, you're certainly welcome.
You're B2BXO. I'm a 1979 graduate of NY Washington Square, and got my MBA, for whatever it's worth, from Stern in 86, so I'm a fellow alumni. Good.
Yeah, I graduated 2 years before you, back in 77.
KE2LBJ. Tony?
Yes, Tony.
Yes, hi, Roy. I'm one of those who learned his engineering experience back in the 70s when everything, you know, like I said, when the market fell apart and it got to the point where schools were coming to your high school to recruit you.
Yeah, that was a very strange time. I mean, NYU had its own engineering building, you know, that they, I think they sold it. It was uptown. But I think Columbia didn't want to do that, so they sent flyers to everyone, including me. And, you know, I mean, I knew why they were doing it. And so there was absolutely no reason to take a bite at that. It's a shame. I don't know exactly what triggered that. I never, unfortunately, kind of researched what the environment was in the late 60s, early 70s, that manifested in this engineering glut and this complete lack of need for new engineers. Maybe it was the time that a lot of manufacturing production was going out of the country or something, but I never really looked into it.
Yeah, and I still went into engineering, but that's okay. I was successful. But, you know, it's funny that that happened right around the time that we transitioned to solid state.
So you think it was the solid state? I don't know. Actually, you know, I thought they kind of started that transition back in the late 50s, early 60s. You know, I mean, unless you're talking about integrated circuits, that was the next phase. But still, the United States had pretty much the business until they kind of gave it away to everyone else. You know, now it's Korea and Taiwan and other places. But, you know, Texas Instruments and those guys, you know, down in Texas, they were it.
Yeah, no, you're right. I agree. But maybe that was just a coincidence. And I went to school. It seemed like, yeah, school to design electronics Yeah, that's, I guess, where the bottom fell out. Then it was, you know, going to, like, technical school, but more as a troubleshooter or, you know, doing maintenance repair.
Well, yeah, I mean, engineering is a broad concept. You know, there are chemical engineers, there are electronic engineers, civil engineers, structural engineers. I can go on and on and on and on. And engineers, you know, I always kind of look at people and try and figure everyone out. And I tend to perceive, I did an article for Limark's newsletter many, many years ago on the differences I sensed in technicians, in engineers, and in research scientists. And at the bottom of my article was that I think we should take a lesson from each of those three and try to be a little bit of all three of them if we can.
I agree, yeah. Yeah, I only have experience in the electronic engineering. But yeah, you're right, it's across the board, all engineering, or most engineering fields that seem to have been the trend. And it's sad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if someone were to ask me back in the 70s if this is going to have real bad repercussions for the United States, I would have told them yes. So somehow either we escaped them or I escaped noticing them, except for poor people who were unemployed. My sister had a close friend whose husband was a chemical engineer, and he ended up having to teach high school in the end because there just were no jobs to be had.
Yeah, I went to school for, you know, for the design aspect of it. I ended up fixing, you know, consumer electronics for years before I finally got into broadcast engineering.
Yeah, you do what you got to do until you find something better. I was very fortunate. I could have taken my chemistry degree and I guess got into chemistry, although, again, those were still the same times where research chemists were probably doing a little bit better than engineers, but not much better. But I decided that medicine would be more fulfilling in more ways than one. And again, like before, I have no second thoughts about it. If I had to do it all over again, I would. There was a great guy who was a regular on this repeater for many years. Unfortunately, he passed away. And once in the middle of the night, he was having a discussion with another guy about me, and he kind of said that Roy could have been anything, and he settled with being a doctor. And I never quite understood that. I mean, I guess it was a compliment. I see nothing wrong in medicine. You get to help people. You get to cure some people, at least treat some people, and make a lot of people feel better. And how do you lose with that?
That was definitely a compliment.
Cat 2CC.
Yeah, I took it as a compliment. He was a great guy. You know, I liked him a great deal. And you know, matter of fact, if you go to the Mike KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv archive, one of the audio files, in addition to the technical net, is we held a 5 or 6 hour wake for John. He was KC2WGB, I believe, and he passed away. And so it went from something like 10 o'clock at night to about 5 o'clock in the morning. So it's still a good listen. So if you pass by that archive site and you see it, you know, click on it, listen a little bit. You might be entertained.
Roy, I think somebody else was trying to break in, I think.
This is Brian, and I want to say it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Roy, and everyone else on the frequency. It's been a very pleasurable conversation, and drop off and go QRT. So I wish everyone a very good evening, and I hope to come back again. 73.
Okay, very good. 73, Brian. Glad to have you here. I enjoyed the conversation. And you know where to find us. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. So have a great week. Stay safe for the 4th of July. Don't blow anything up.
Likewise. I wish everyone the best, and I will keep your website active on my system. And this is KF2ZZ. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Brian. Well, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am the control operator for this Delimar Technical Net. We're still open for business. We got a good half hour. If anyone wants to entertain any questions or comments, if anyone wants to go back to any of the many subjects that were discussed earlier tonight, it's an open board there.
K2LBJ.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back on when there was this discussion about this catapult and the moon. Nothing technical. It was just reminded me of something from when I was a kid.
Well, I mean, it's very possible you. I think it was The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. It was written by Robert Heinlein back in the late 50s, early 60s. And I think it had a catapult, too.
Yeah, this catapult was a kid's TV show back in the 60s. I'm sure you remember it, Fireball XL5.
Ooh, I remember those. Was that the ones with the puppets?
Yeah, the one with the puppets. But that one, the rocket took off on a long track, probably like a railgun, and then separated once it launched.
Yeah, there was a lot of
feedback.
Yes, Brian?
I was just listening to that comment, and I remember the movie When Worlds Collide, that had the catapult.
Yes, it does. That's right. That's right. I guess we all remember the Thunderbirds and et cetera.
Well,
like we're up with that.
All of us of a certain age, though. There are wonderful people out there who would look at you and I and just kind of shrug and pick up their cell phone and play some kind of game.
Oh, look it up.
Okay, once again, 73, everyone. Up.
Okay, 73, Brian. Yeah, I would hope at least they'd look it up. But unfortunately, intellectual curiosity is not universal. You know, the bane of my existence is the rare time when some younger person, I ask them, you know, how a TV works, and their response is, you plug it in and turn it on. And, you know, I tend to despair for the youth. But I've also known young people that are incredibly inquisitive and want to know how everything works. So, you know, it depends who you ask these questions to, I guess.
A comment?
Sure.
It is a variation of the catapult was, I think it was in an Arthur Clarke story, Fountains of Paradise, the tether. Where they had an object in orbit that was actually tethered to the ground, and they were actually able to take an elevator up to it to get to an orbital position.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff written about space elevators, and every so often, especially when new materials are investigated, one of the many claims that someone somewhere made about graphene is that it could be used as the cable for our own space elevators. That's been in fiction for a long time, and people every so often break it out and say, you think we could do that here? Which I, you know, again, who knows what future materials will be, but with the present materials we have, I tend to doubt it. But yeah, that was one of the solutions, because I mean, that's what science fiction writers often try to do, find scientifically reasonable ways out of a problem.
Yeah, it's made for interesting fiction.
People have these interesting kind of long-winded discussions about science fiction for about an hour and a half. They all wanted to be called speculative fiction, but that never really took off, so they went back to science fiction. And a lot of people mix up science fiction with fantasy, which they're kind of different things. And then there's soft science fiction and hard science fiction, where the reasoning behind it is relatively more firm with hard science fiction than soft science fiction. But, you know, there's all kinds of different flavors, but as long as you can write a decent story, because I don't read science fiction to learn how science works. I kind of learn, you know, how human beings work, if you will. Yeah, you're a little bit noisy. If you could adjust your antenna or pick up the gain something, that would help.
Yeah, I figured that. Is this okay?
Yeah, it's okay. There's, you know, about 10-20% noise in the background, but I can understand what you're saying.
All right, I'm not listening long. I haven't hearing the beep. Can anybody tell me of a recent use of a catapult?
Okay, I don't know offhand, but it's not like I keep abreast of all catapult activity. Anyone else want to take up that challenge?
All right, it was in the newspaper. It was used in Israel by the Israeli troops.
Oh, okay. I mean, military-wise, there's a lot of similar action elsewhere. I was watching a YouTube about Ukrainian drones, and they have a new model drone that basically gets bayoneted to hoist into the air, and then it runs on its own motor power. So catapult-like activity is probably not uncommon in weapon systems militarily.
Okay, very good. I won't stay in, but the kind of catapult they used was fireballs. They were sending fireballs with it. I'll sign out. I'll just be listening. Thank you, WB2CQT.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, catapults and trebuchets were both used as military weapons for centuries. Something had to get over the moat and the walls and such. And so it was not unusual for the enemy to use them. Anyone else with any comments on any of these subjects?
Yeah, hi, Roy. KE2LBJ. Yeah, before I mention those shows, because I've only been on the air for about 6 months, and it seems to me that it's more of my generation, our generation, than younger. And actually, even the fests or meetings I attended, it seems to be the case. And I just thought there might be some others out there who grew up the same time I did.
Yeah, I agree with you to a degree. It's unfortunate that the hobby tends to skew geriatrically. If you go to any kind, if you go to YouTube and you look for Hamfest, you'll see a lot of people going around in motorized wheelchairs. Unfortunately, you know, if you go to comic book conventions, not so many motorized wheelchairs. A lot of people running around looking freaky as hell, but they tend to skew younger. But we do have younger members. We have Craig, who I haven't heard tonight. He's in his 20s. I have another club in Brooklyn, the Kings County Radio Club. And we have about 75 members, and 8 or 9 of them are in their late 20s, early 30s. So there are younger people. It's just that the majority are... we're in our 60s, 70s, and some people, God bless them, 80s. So, yeah, it's much more likely for a net to have members that remember the good old days than not. But there are still members out there that are youngsters. God bless them.
WSQN. Keep the hobby going. Hey, this is KE2LBJ. I'm going to be listening, Roy. I love the show. Actually, I'm one of the listeners who very rarely calls in, you know, push the talk.
Okay, and I hope we have enough people who push the talk to keep the net alive for many years to come, because you know, you don't want to hear me just give a soliloquy, I assure you. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I'm sure we all remember the comic Wile E. Coyote. He was always chasing after the Roadrunner, and he would attach him. He would take rope and attach himself to a rocket, and sometimes go onto some kind of a gadget, spin himself around, and to try to catch Roadrunner. But I remember that very well, and you know, I actually had a picture of that, you know, of Wile E. Coyote attached to the rocket, and I think I sent it to Dick years ago, and it was actually pretty funny. But now, that is this company, Spin Launch, S-P-I-N Launch, and they're actually trying to do something like this. Like I said before, they've got this gigantic concrete thing that they built, a big circular, it's perpendicular to the ground, and they evacuate the inside of it, creates a vacuum, and then they attach a projectile to it, and then they spin this thing. I think it's around 100 feet in diameter. They spin this thing at 10,000 RPM, and then they release it, and supposed to be able to get up to 4,000 or 5,000 miles per hour, and enough to get to near space anyway. You know, probably 40 or 50 kilometers up, and then at that point it would have, they don't have it yet, but it would have a second stage coming off of it. But I'm a Wile E. Coyote. Anyway, back to you, WS2S.
AC2GS. Well, I'm sure you didn't see it in the original form. Originally, those cartoons were a part of the Saturday afternoon matinee. Kids would go to the movies and they'd see the Warner Brothers short cartoons. You probably saw them, as I did, on your TV when they were kind of syndicated and shown regularly all over the place on TVs. And I tell you, I remember it so well that I actually have a little statue of Marvin the Martian Russ right behind me in my shack as I speak.
Okay, that's very good. By the way, this club has nostalgia net. Not every month, but if the month has 5 Wednesdays in the month, so it only happens a couple of times a year, but if it has 5 Wednesdays in a month, on that 5th Wednesday, then they have a nostalgia net on these frequencies. And it comes on at 8:30, and I always find them terrific. They go back in time. They cover a lot of different topics. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I remember one time I twirled by, and for some odd reason, Rich was doing the entire night on presidents. You know, who was the fattest president, who was the skinniest president, who was the tallest president, who was the shortest president, and on and on and on. So, I don't know. Nostalgia in the old days, if you actually look up the word nostalgia etiology, it originally came into existence as a form of disease. People suffered nostalgia in the same way they suffered homesickness.
What, they were longing for the good old days? Is that what it was?
Yeah, that was the affliction at the time. It's kind of slowly morphed over the years. But back in the original etiology of the term, it was a description for someone who had a problem. Because, you know, they longed a little too much for the good old days. I mean, the beauty of our memory is memories are plastic things. Some people refuse to believe it. We reshape them. We reform them regularly. That's why eyewitness reports are not terribly useful, because people report all kinds of nonsense. And so when we look back, every time we kind of replay our history in our minds, we kind of erase the previous version and print the latest, greatest version. So, you know, you never quite know if things that you think you remembered, you really remembered. I remember distinctly ordering a desk when Dama got killed. And one day I looked at the dates and I realized that I had bought a desk, but it wasn't that, the desk I thought I bought. It was something like 10 years earlier. So that memory was completely kaput. So it's just an interesting thing of word ideologies, that nostalgia was something that had to be treated like any other sickness.
I guess that would come under the psychiatry group, you know. I don't know, when I was younger, the psychiatrists and the chiropractors weren't even covered by insurance, by any of the insurance companies, you know. I mean, things have changed even in the last 60-some-odd years.
AC2GS. Well, I mean, the only constant in the universe is change. Psychiatry has been completely made. Freudian psychology is held in contempt by a lot of psychiatrists. This fixation with infantile sexuality and such was nonsense, and everyone now knows he tended to have a cocaine addiction. He was not a terribly good neurologist before he kind of turned his eye to psychiatry, and a lot of his theories didn't really pan out, and the people he was mentored to, Jung and other clinical psychiatrists, their theories didn't really go anywhere. Ultimately, among other things, it was kind of the MIT biochemistry model of the brain that kind of changed the nature of psychiatry and provided all kinds of pharmaceuticals that are used to this day. So it's a different field entirely than it was, you know, in our childhood. You know, where guys who tried to grow a beard sat there with a pen and a pad and scribbled down what you thought of your mother.
Yeah. What would the movie industry do without stories like that? Countless couch patients. Anyway, I'm going to listen out and wait for the space that back to you, or.
Okie doke. I mean, my favorite psychological movie as a child was All About Eve. That was interesting. Kind of overdiagnosed multiple personalities for the next 50 years, but what the hell. It was a good movie. Anyway, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limark Technical Net. We got a little bit more time if anyone is interested. So if anyone has anything to ask or tell or discuss, hit that push to talk.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, John.
Yeah, good evening, Roy. Good evening, Ned. Great Ned, as always. As a just quickie, I was listening to one of these podcasts, and these two guys were talking back and forth, and they had a little bit of quantum mechanics involved in it, and one of them mentioned to the other experiment that was done in London where they taught rats to do a certain thing, and that's all he really said about it, and he says, and the amazing thing was that people that were studying rats in New York suddenly observed them doing the same behavior, and the other gentleman on the podcast agreed, yeah, you know, I've seen that, da, 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 da. You know, again, they didn't elaborate on it. It sounded very, you know, intriguing, and that I was just wondering if yourself or anyone else heard about this.
Well, yes and no. Are we going back to Joe Rogan again and his interview with that actor?
It might have been. I do remember Rogan, and yeah, that actor guy was one of the guys that were always on there. But Rogan seemed to have heard of it too. So it, you know, it seemed to be independent of the two of them. Some sort of test, experiment, study. You know, again, they didn't elaborate on it much.
Okay. See, I haven't heard about it in the literature or anything significant like that. I heard about it as a dismissive comment from someone who was putting down, you know, what's his face, the actor. He kind of critiqued the Rogan interview, and along he just kept on going, and he was talking about something like this and something like that, and then he said that there was a rat that they taught in one country that another rat in another country learned, And so that's the only way that I heard of it. There is no proof that telepathy exists whatsoever. Your brain cannot send messages to someone else, and they can't send messages to you. You have no transceiver. You have no transmitter. You have no receiver. Your brain is an electrochemical network that triggers ion channels off and on locally. There's no kind of organized signal that kind of comes off of your brain into another. So the idea that mice can telepathically learn something is highly dubious.
Yeah, I didn't take it as telepathy. I would agree with you. I would have just, like, totally dismissed it. I do remember living in New York and watching a couple of documentaries on rats and people who were fortunately had. And I remember one interesting, one gentleman, and he had an apartment. He was the type of individual killing anything, capturing them. And what they began to notice was he would capture them, release them, and then the same rats would come back. And he was released further and further and further away. And